What if fascism came wrapped in the American flag? This was the question Sinclair Lewis posed in 1935 with his prophetic novel, It Can't Happen Here. Written as Hitler and Mussolini consolidated power abroad, Lewis dared Americans to confront an uncomfortable truth: democracy's fragility exists everywhere, even here. The novel follows newspaper editor Doremus Jessup as he witnesses his small Vermont town and the entire nation transform under the spell of a charismatic demagogue named Brazilius Buzz Windrip. Through this fictional America's descent into authoritarianism, Lewis crafted not just a political warning, but a psychological examination of how ordinary citizens respond when democracy crumbles around them. The novel's title has become shorthand for political complacency, while its renewed popularity during various political moments, including a 320% sales surge after the 2016 election, speaks to its enduring relevance as a mirror for American anxieties. Buzz Windrip transforms physical plainness into charisma through sheer personality. On stage, he's dynamic, banging tables, quoting biblical wrath, then cooing maternally. His substance-free speeches create illusory personal connections with listeners, seemingly revealing hidden truths to each. Windrip's danger lies in his authentic, professional, common man persona. He embodies average American prejudices, loving buckwheat cakes, worshiping Henry Ford, disdaining foreigners. His 15 points of victory for the forgotten men promises everything from guaranteed income to punishment for un-American elements. Behind him operates the truly sinister Lee Saracen, a calculating intellectual who crafts the ideology Windrip merely performs. They build a coalition of the desperate: mortgaged farmers, unemployed workers, publicity-hungry preachers, and struggling professionals. Democracy crumbles with shocking speed. Within 8 days of inauguration, Windrip declares martial law, arrests opposing congressmen, and his Minutemen open fire on protesters. The intimidated Congress grants the president unchecked authority. When Bishop Prang, once Windrip's supporter, confronts him in Washington, he emerges pale and staggering. Soon after, the government announces he's gone melancholy mad and institutionalized. No one ever sees Bishop Prang again. The regime transforms America with ruthless efficiency. Social workers must inform on communities or face deportation to concentration camps run by Minutemen outside judicial oversight. Local MM officers become warlords, creating arbitrary laws targeting Jewish professionals, Negro journalists, socialistic professors, and questioning women, following a pattern of warning, assault, then disappearance. While resistance writers commit to facts, the corpo machine deploys prestigious voices: college presidents, radio personalities, corporate experts. Newspapers eliminate liberal viewpoints and international news, replacing them with underground mocking comics, sensationalized crime, and fabricated statistics. The American humor, once thought to protect against fascism, vanishes within a year. Economic indicators are manipulated. Unemployment figures exclude camp prisoners while counting their forced labor as production. Most insidiously, citizens begin self-censoring, watching neighbors and measuring words, knowing casual conversations might become evidence of sedition. The machinery runs not just on violence, but on fear that transforms people into willing participants in their own subjugation. At 60, Doremus Jessup embodies 19th century individualism rather than 20th century conformity. Though self-described as a mild, rather indolent, and somewhat sentimental liberal, he genuinely hates cruelty. His initial wait-and-see approach toward the corpo regime becomes unsustainable as oppression intensifies. The breaking point comes when Secretary McGoblin murders two scholars during an anti-Semitic rampage, yet is acquitted on self-defense. Doremus writes a scathing editorial condemning the murderous extirpation of honest opposition. The next day, Commissioner Shad Ledoux, Doremus's former handyman, now in power, arrives with armed MMs to seize the newspaper. When Doremus's son-in-law protests, he's executed in the courtyard. After release, Doremus works under a new editor, managing small resistances like his Yao Yao editorials with strong anti-corpo arguments followed by deliberately weak rebuttals. He constantly questions why he stays, torn between conscience and protecting his family. His struggle mirrors countless others under dictatorships, ordinary people trying to maintain dignity while protecting loved ones through compromises that slowly erode their souls. When Walt Trowbridge escapes to Canada after losing to Windrip, he establishes the new underground network for resistance. The organization reaches Doranus through Mr. Dimmick, an unassuming insurance salesman visiting Fort Beulah. Doremus sets up a secret printing operation in Buck Titus's basement, producing increasingly sophisticated propaganda. Their paper, Vermont Vigilance, becomes vital for distributing uncensored news through trusted carriers. The Fort Beulah resistance cell grows diverse. Doremus's daughters use social positions as cover. Buck provides his basement and finances. Lorinda Pike's hotel serves as a message center. Julian couriers materials. Dr. Olmsted treats wounded members. John Polycop brings organization experience. And Father Parifex offers church sanctuary. Mary Greenhill transforms most dramatically after her husband's murder. She trades widow's clothes for bright attire, appearing frivolous to avoid suspicion, while becoming their most daring operative. Sissy gathers intelligence by feigning interest in Shad Ledoux, nearly ending in disaster when he becomes violent. This network shows how ordinary citizens become extraordinary heroes when democracy vanishes, not overnight, but through incremental acts of courage where each small step enables the next. The resistance pays dearly. Doremus receives 17 years in a concentration camp with a suspended death sentence, where guards force-feed him castor oil before whipping him unconscious with a steel rod. At Trianon camp, horrors abound. Doremus witnesses his cousin's execution after an escape attempt, Julian Falk's torture, and Reverend Falk reduced to scavenging garbage. When guards claim father and son betrayed each other, an MM kicks the elderly minister to the floor. Before dying, Reverend Falk curses his tormentors, for they know what they do. Mary Greenhill joins the Corpo Women's Flying Corps, learning to fly before pursuing Commissioner Swan with stolen grenades. When they miss, she deliberately crashes into his aircraft, her final thoughts drifting to childhood memories and her son David. These sacrifices frame the novel's central question: what price are we willing to pay for freedom? What compromises can we accept before losing our essential humanity? Lewis shows tyranny's true cost isn't measured economically, but in human dignity. Lewis portrays fascism not as a foreign import, but as embedded within American ideology. The transformation occurs through familiar channels: newspapers self-censoring, organizations conforming, neighbors growing suspicious. Fascism exploits existing divisions, economic anxiety, racial resentment, cultural grievances, just as it did in Europe. When Doremus reflects on his complicity, he realizes the tyranny of this dictatorship isn't primarily the fault of big business or demagogues, it's the fault of Doremus Jessup. This self-indictment resonates because Doremus represents the educated middle class who should have recognized the danger signs but dismissed them as temporary aberrations. The novel's most unsettling aspect is how ordinary citizens accommodate fascism through small acts of compliance. Business owners see advantages in the new system. Intellectuals justify silence. Neighbors report neighbors out of fear or personal gain. This remains the novel's most powerful message. Democracy's greatest threat isn't external invasion, but internal complacency, the belief that it can't happen here. Democratic decay follows consistent patterns across time and place. When we say it can't happen here, we've already taken the first step toward ensuring that it can.